This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt. Coming up, the pro-France lobby win the day for a second time in New Caledonia, but with a third referendum to come, the gap is narrowing. As Fiji marks 50 years of independence, is there political turmoil lurking behind the smiles? And the new chairman of the FRU determined to leave the past behind and find a way into Super Rugby for the Fijian Bundoora. Those stories to come, but first the overwhelming vote for independence in Bougainville and now the election of a new president for the autonomous region appears to have spooked Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape. He has raised the possibility of a change to the constitution to prevent any other PNG province from promoting the subject of independence or autonomy, labelling it as an act of sedition. But the governor of Enga, who in theory secured a degree of autonomy for his province under the previous government 2 years ago, says Mr. Marape has nothing to fear.
We will pass a law in the national parliament. Whoever talks about independence, they will be charged with sedition. We will pass this law so that other parts of the country must not talk about autonomy or independence. Bougainville is special and they have done it, but others must not talk about it.
Bougainville and special line, all making finish.
Prime Minister Marape's comments during a post-election visit to Bougainville drew cheers from the locals. And speaking to reporters, Mr. Marape underlined his concerns.
Securing the rest of PNG together first is important before we even go down and sending this, because I can't afford other parts of our country also entertaining the thoughts of autonomy and then referendum, because they have an island of gold somewhere or they have a mountain of oil somewhere. The union of our 1,000 tribes is fundamentally important first.
So is Mr. Marape right to be concerned? Constitutional lawyer Bal Karma believes the Prime Minister is trying to achieve a balancing act.
I think he's aware of existing demands as well in other provinces, in that he's trying to balance that with the greater need for PNG to be united to avoid any fragmentation from within. At the same time, those debates playing out affect conversations on Bougainville. So by providing that assurance, I think that could be a way to minimize opposition to discussions about Bougainville's future.
But how far do those demands in other provinces actually go? 2 years ago, New Ireland, East New Britain and Enga all signed an intergovernment agreement with the then Prime Minister Peter O'Neill. But Enga's governor, Sir Peter Ipetar, says that deal came to nothing.
When we signed up, we were of the opinion that they would decentralize some of the functions like works, finance, police. Those are some of the functions that are more relevant for us in the province. But since the signing, nothing happened. It was probably a political gimmick.
But Sir Peter says the fact that his province didn't get what it signed up to hasn't changed the objective. And he argues there are already sufficient protections in the constitution to prevent his or any other province from setting off on a path to independence.
People think that autonomy eventually leads to secession, like Bougainville, the agenda of independence. So in Enga's context, we wouldn't want to use the word autonomy. But what we want to see is Waigani devolve powers and functions to the provinces. And Enga being where we are, isolated from Waigani, we would like to see more powers devolved to us so that we can manage our own affairs to an extent.
However, the views expressed by the Governor of New Ireland, Sir Julius Chan, on Independence Day in PNG just last month, add a slightly different flavour to the argument.
If I call him New Ireland Legislative Assembly.
We called it the New Ireland Legislative Assembly because we are thinking of moving towards autonomy. There were songs sung in New Ireland that talk about moving towards being an autonomous part of PNG. This is a call from the people themselves, and the PNG government must recognize this.
We hope to see much more clarity, and questions will be coming from people like Sir Julius Chan as to what exactly the Prime Minister is.
However, Anne-Marie O'Keefe, now a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute, but for many years head of the AusAid program in Papua New Guinea, says Balkama's hope may be hard to fulfil.
Clarity can sometimes be an ambitious goal in Papua New Guinea. Sometimes what's said is the signal and follow-up action doesn't necessarily happen because you've actually achieved what you wanted to achieve. I think the fact that there hasn't been any action on the intergovernment agreement that was signed 2 years ago is interesting in itself. It probably served its purpose at the time. but in actual fact, it's not gone anywhere. This could be the same.
But while Balcarmer is of the opinion that Mr. Marape is not expecting a push for autonomy from any province, he believes he is open to a degree of economic independence, but nothing more.
Marape's announcement is providing a clearer path towards what Papua New Guinea should look like in the future. He's setting a clear boundary that shouldn't amount to any claim for political autonomy or independence. So it is early stages now, but the message appears to be clear now from Prime Minister Marape, and that will guide conversations on Bougainville going forward.
We don't know what the end game is here for Marape. He's been quite strong in recent months in terms of taking control of resources. We saw that with Porgera. And the fact that he's taking over responsibility for the Bougainville portfolio is a signal that he's very much going to ensure that the negotiations with Bougainville towards independence go the way he wants them to go.
Which way Mr. Marape wants those talks to go is a question Ms. O'Keefe says she can't answer, but she's sure what the Prime Minister most definitely doesn't want is the Bougainville feel-good factor spilling over into other provinces.
You don't want that sort of sentiment moving into other parts of the country. I can understand Marape's concern. I'm sure O'Neill had similar concerns. Any Prime Minister would. It's not good to lose part of your country on your watch, and particularly if it's a part of the country that potentially contributes significantly to the broader country's income.
But in Enga, Sir Peter Ipetas says by giving his province more control over its own destiny, far from weakening the nation, it would strengthen it.
They shouldn't fear provinces from having more responsibility because we are mandated by the people. The national government must understand that. Now, the people expect me to run an efficient government that is meeting the aspirations and the needs of our people. If Wagani does not support us in this endeavour, then this country will not progress.
At this stage, there appears to have been no consultation between the Prime Minister and Provisional Governors on the possibility of changing the constitution to, in effect, outlaw the very mention of autonomy or independence. But Sir Peter Ipetas says what the government in Waigani could do is actually use the provisions that are already in the constitution to give provinces like his the extra powers they are seeking, and all would be well.
We as a country, by law, by constitution, have no provision for somebody becoming independent. There is provision for decentralizing of powers, so provincial governments and local governments become more effective at their level. The problem is that national government think that they know it all.
Sir Peter Ipetas, the governor of Enga province in Papua New Guinea. Now, voters in New Caledonia have narrowly rejected independence for a second time in 2 years, with the majority choosing once again to remain with France. But the margin between the yes and no camps was a lot closer than in 2018. And as Priyanka Srinivasan reports, some pro-independence leaders say that shows their support base in the French Pacific Territory is growing.
It was a night where the losers celebrated louder than the winners. Provisional results showed slightly more than 53% of people voted no to 47% for yes. Approximately 10,000 votes separated the two sides. But it was pro-independence voters that took to the streets of Noumea, honking their horns, waving Kanaki flags, and singing in unison. It was a stronger result for the yes camp than the previous referendum in 2018, where 43% of voters supported independence. That may have been down to an increase in numbers at polling booths that seemed to work in favour of independence.
La première action, c'est une grande joie.
Aloisio Sarko, a pro-independence leader, said his reaction to the results when they were first announced was one of great joy. He said, considering a 4-point increase in the yes vote compared to 2018, that the night felt like a victory, even if they didn't succeed in gaining a majority of the vote.
We feel so happy.
Fellow pro-independence campaigner Margali Tingal says she marks the result as a success as well.
We feel like our yes campaign has increased all over the country. I believe that the population of New Caledonia, not only Kanaks people, has understand that the yes means peace, means future. We win tonight. Yeah. We are not the winner, but we win.
Ethnic and geographic divisions persisted in this year's vote. Regions with a high population of indigenous Kanak voters favoured independence, as was the case back in 2018. At celebrations for the no vote, in a bar overlooking the marina in a chic part of the capital Noumea, a modest celebration among anti-independence voters, they gathered under French flags to welcome a second vote in their favour. Anti-independence politician Carl Nguela said he was positive with the result of the vote, since the majority of New Caledonians wished to remain with France. He said that a lot of young voters who may have been interested in the pro-independence movement voted no at the polls yesterday, since they either felt New Caledonia wasn't ready to become its own country or that they didn't want to lose the benefits given to them by France. The vote is the latest step in a long journey towards New Caledonia's decolonization. The peace process was first triggered more than 30 years ago when the territory fell into a bloody civil conflict between pro-independence activists, French loyalists, and the French state. They came together to stop the violence and negotiate a process towards self-determination. The referendum is the second of three possible independence votes, as outlined by a 1998 peace deal called the Noumea Accord.
Nous savons aujourd'hui que nous sommes à la croisée des chemins.
In a speech to the nation following the vote, French President Emmanuel Macron said a third referendum on independence was possible. He said the nation was at a crossroads and that voters had 2 years ahead of them to discuss and imagine the future.
Vive la Nouvelle-Calédonie, vive la République. Vive la France.
Paris has signalled an increased focus on the Indo-Pacific region, and many see its Pacific territories, like New Caledonia, as a key part of that strategy. Electoral officials and international observers reported a peaceful and secure vote throughout the day. If approved by a majority in Congress, New Caledonia will hold the third and final referendum by 2022.
Priyanka Srinivasan reporting there, and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. This week has been a week of celebration in Fiji ahead of the 50th anniversary of the country's independence on October the 10th. A new song has been written for the day itself, accompanied by an independence logo, new currency, and the presentation of medals to significant citizens. But as Nick Fogarty reports, concerns remain about Fiji's prospects for political stability in a post-COVID-19 economy.
In English, Italkai, Fiji, Hindi and Rotoman languages, Fiji celebrates 50 years as an independent nation through the new anthem, Children of Fiji. Speaking at the launch of the song, which was composed with the government broadcaster FBC, Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama said it was the anthem of the moment.
One that captures the spirit of courage and compassion, which has carried our people through hardship time and again.
It was October 10, 1874, when King Seru Epenitha Tsakabau ceded Fiji to the United Kingdom, and the same day in 1970 that they regained their independence. The country's been periodically thrown into political turmoil in the decades since, becoming a republic in 1987 after a military coup, followed by further coups in 2000 and 2006, as well as several rewrites of the constitution and suspension from the Commonwealth, which was lifted in 2014, when the country held elections which consolidated Frank Bainimarama's power. At the moment, the country is trying to take a leadership role on climate change while fighting to protect its people and economy from the worst effects of COVID-19. Alicia Barno is the founder of Fijian youth activist group Acted Network and says the anniversary is a good time to reflect on her Fijian identity.
I take a lot of pride in being a Fijian and a Pacific Islander, and I think a lot of my identity is shaped with being born and raised in the Pacific. And personally, I quite like the stand Fiji makes on a lot of climate change front. It feels like they're doing a very head prefect in the school of Pacific Island sort of role.
Alongside that, though, the COVID-19 pandemic is throwing up additional challenges for Fiji's population, including mass job losses in the tourism industry.
There are issues of petty crime. There are issues of domestic violence. There are issues of mental health. And there are issues of, people having that uncertainty in terms of when do we return to normal, developing a new normal.
Things have been politically stable in Fiji since the 2014 election, but Australian National University Pacific Politics expert Stuart Firth says an event like the COVID-19 pandemic risks shaking things up.
Fiji has not been going too badly since 2014, and indeed there have been measures taken by the government like free education and free medical care for the poor and so on, which have put it way ahead of any other independent Pacific Islands country. So there is that. But the trouble is COVID-19 has absolutely punched a hole in the Fiji economy, and the government is in the position of having to borrow enormously in order to keep the civil service going. But there could be a very serious debt crunch in the coming years.
Stuart Firth says that what he sees as a power imbalance at the top could further test the COVID pressure point.
Fiji's great weakness at the moment is that it's governed just by two men, Frank Bainimarama and Ayaz Sayed Kayom, who is the Attorney General and Minister for the Economy. And that's led it into a rather undemocratic position. I mean, particularly as Bainimarama takes much less interest in government than Ayaz Sayed Kayom. Now, if Bainimarama were not there for whatever reason, one might see a serious political situation in Fiji once again. Remembering that the Constitution of 2013 provides for the military to be responsible for the well-being of the people of Fiji. So, in other words, in another crisis, and now we have a situation with COVID-19 which may create a crisis, it would not be unexpected if the military were to intervene.
In the meantime, though, Fiji can celebrate the 32 winners of the 50th Anniversary Independence Medal, awarded by the Fiji College of Honour. It's a list that includes former Prime Minister Mahendra Chaudhry, numerous military and police leaders, and Tessa McKenzie, who designed the Fijian flag that was first raised at Suva's Albert Park on Independence Day 50 years ago.
That's Nick Fogarty reporting. And finally, for this edition of Pacific Review, the chairman of the Fiji Rugby Union says he's determined to find a home for the Ndrua in Super Rugby, be that in New Zealand or Australia. Conway Begg says the FRU's bid to join the New Zealand competition is still under discussion and talks with Rugby Australia are ongoing. Meanwhile, any findings from two investigations into allegations of bullying and homophobia against his predecessor, Francis Keane, are still to be made public. But Mr. Begg says he wants to leave the past behind and concentrate on growing the game in a country where 1 in 20 of the population is a registered player. And after a highly successful run in Australia's national championship, turning the Fijian Ndrua into a Super Rugby franchise is a high priority.
The great entertainers, they are the champions. The Fijian Ndrua win the National Rugby Championship. And what a moment for this small island nation.
If you do your research on how much one of these games is worth in terms of indirect revenue to where the game's played, in other words, the country, it's quite huge. So from our perspective, if we're building capacity within our country, then we're going in as a Fiji team, as the Ndrua. We're going to strengthen our player pathway along those lines. It's important that in the Super Club competition, that aligns further down in our governance structure with playing structures as well, aligning that so that we do have a stronger pathway, because to compete at international level, it is tough. And we need intensity and competitions like this to be in. In terms of New Zealand, they're carefully looking at it. Obviously, they want to make sure that teams are competitive. We're of the view that we may not be competitive in 2021, but we're definitely looking at the 2022 window.
With Australia in the mix as well, the Ndrua has a presence in Australia. The Ndrua have won the Australian National Championship, which is the tier below Super Rugby, but nevertheless, that's a pretty good foundation. So might you be better off going into the Australian competition?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're thankful to Australia. You know, the Ndrua did extremely well, and that shows the level of competition and what competition does when you do have some governance and structure in your union. We would welcome that and probably have further talks with Rugby Australia about that. You know, there is some talks at the moment. Rugby Australia has that firm connection with the Ndrua. the draw's success has been fathomed in Australia, and that success can be built further. So yeah, why not? We'd like to extend that talk and see what happens around the scrum.
The impact, obviously, of COVID-19 and travel restrictions clearly are going to play a part in the decision making in terms of the competition, certainly in 2021 in New Zealand and Australia for that matter. But generally speaking, how would you assess the financial health of the Fiji Rugby Union? Are you coping in these difficult circumstances?
It goes without saying. These are tough times for everyone. We are struggling. We are coping. A lot of rugby being played at the moment. We have the Skipper Cup at the provincial level and then the Tier 2 level below that with women's rugby and under 20s. In our coffers, we're balancing at the moment. All I can say is we're quite healthy for now, but anything can change due to uncertainty. You know, given sponsorship, you know, that's been tough as well. Look at Australia with their sponsorship. Qantas have pulled the plug on that one. And, you know, as a small island nation like us, we're certainly looking at that and ensuring that we keep sustainability on that moving forward.
What would you therefore see as your priorities in the next few months? Because we've touched on the Endura and the hope that they will find a place in Super Rugby either in Australia or in New Zealand. The Flying Fijians have got a big tournament coming up in November over in the Northern Hemisphere up against a whole host of Tier 1 nations. And then, of course, it's the small matter of defending the Rugby Sevens gold medal at the Olympics in Tokyo next year. Those are three big-ticket items, aren't they?
If you're very passionate about it, you can sort your priorities. I think we have a very good team in Rugby House at the moment. I think that's something that most of you don't know. We've been building a very good team in-house. There's a lot, too, that should be added to that. The World Cup for the Fijiana, the under-20s tournament, which I was certainly looking forward to, got canned. We don't know what's happening with that. That's certainly a very big part of our game now. And certainly, if I'm coming on board, I'm wanting to address the school structure in Fiji, aligning that. We lose a lot of our players to unscrupulous agents, and that's something we want to hone in as well. If we're going to build capacity, if we're going to build pathway alignment, we really need to address this. Those are key issues if you want to build a foundation. We also want to work on fostering our relationship, our proud history with Australia and New Zealand. That's something we want to develop as we move forward, how we can work together to give us more game time, more international test fixtures, not only with New Zealand and Australia, but our other neighbours in the south, extending across to South Africa and Argentina. I haven't spoken to any of them, but I certainly want to reach out and start talking to them. And there's a lot. It's like a strong mix of things that we have to address, and we have to get to the bottom of it.
My understanding is, as a result of the pandemic, quite a few players that might have been in Europe are currently not. They're back in the islands. Does that therefore make it more important that if you can push the Endura's case to have a spot in Super Rugby, that you could actually have some very good players who might not otherwise been available? They would have been playing in Europe.
Absolutely. When you build a pathway, if our super bid goes in and we have equal opportunity for our players in terms of salary structure, what we can offer them in comparison to, say, what's happening in New Zealand, Australia, and probably the North, we can't compete there, but we're certainly going to work towards that to give that growth and give our players here an opportunity to stay closer to home, you know, happy player and keep that nucleus strong. If you look at the player welfare, it's been really tough on our players, not just Fiji, but Pacific players up in the north. We want to inspire younger players and develop that capacity through our playing structures.
Now, when you took over as chairman of the Fiji Rugby Union, I think it's fair to say you moved into the top job at a difficult time. I mean, you will be well aware, international rugby was well aware that your predecessor, Francis Keane, had been under investigation by World Rugby and by the FRU. Do you see part of your role now as restoring the FRU's reputation, which certainly as far as the international media was concerned, was a little tarnished?
Oh, you know, there's always that talk, but I can't undo the past, but I certainly can influence the future prospects for Fiji Rugby, you know, moving forward. I'm not the one to look over my shoulder in the past. It's like Bob Dylan blowing in the wind. Let's blow our sails towards the draw, which is, you know, it's an exciting prospect for us, whether it sets sail towards New Zealand or Australia. I certainly would like to think that there are some good things that are going to happen in this rethink of rugby worldwide.
I mentioned that your predecessor, Francis Keane, was under investigation by yourselves and World Rugby. Are the findings for those investigations ever going to see the light of day, or is this whole matter gone away now?
Well, I at this point in time, it's probably unfair of me to comment on that. I think it's been put to bed. There are more important things to talk about. It's been dealt with strongly, and I'm now in this position to see it forward. As I said, you know, let's not dwell on the past. Let's look forward. And I hope that the rest of the world and people like yourself and the media can look to me for further answers and coming back with more positive statements.
Conway Begg, who took over in August as chairman of the Fiji Rugby Union, on the line there from Suva, and rounding out this edition of Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt, and as always, thank you very much for listening.